May it please the court, Ann Hester representing D'Angelo Whiteside. As we now know, after Simmons, D'Angelo Whiteside never should have been sentenced as a career offender. That designation nearly doubled his guideline range, and it increased his sentence by about 8 years. Unlike ordinary guidelines, the career offender guideline is the result of a congressional mandate that sentences be at or near the statutory maximum. And unlike ordinary guidelines, the circumstances of the offense, such as the type and amount of drugs, whether there were weapons or violence involved, and the defendant's role in the offense, play no role in determining punishment for career offenders. The career offender error in Whiteside's case is cognizable on collateral review because it violates due process, and it also is a fundamental defect that inherently results in a complete miscarriage of justice. Three factors combined here to prohibit the district court from sentencing Whiteside at or below the correct guideline range once it had designated him a career offender. Those three factors are post-Booker sentencing procedures that harness sentences to the guidelines, meaningful appellate review for substantive reasonableness, and in this case, an erroneous mandatory minimum sentence that prohibited the district court from sentencing Whiteside below 20 years for reasons other than substantial assistance. Under Hicks, that removal of discretion violates due process. But the court doesn't have to decide the merits of the due process issue here, because as the panel majority recognized, Whiteside's sentence also is a fundamental defect that inherently creates a complete miscarriage of justice. And the panel recognized this for two reasons. First of all, the panel properly recognized that career offender designation is not an ordinary guideline error. In addition to the differences that I've already outlined, career offender sentences treat all offenders alike, even when their offenses are not alike, by disconnecting the sentence from all offense characteristics.
Doesn't our court in Pettiford and the Supreme Court recognize a substantial difference between what might be an ordinary ordinary error, and what would constitute a miscarriage of justice? A miscarriage of justice is something where the legal proceeding wasn't even worth the name.
Well, the Supreme Court has never said that, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has specifically said that an error that arises after the conviction that makes the conviction itself invalid is a miscarriage of justice on the one hand, and on the other hand, in cases like Hill and Timrek, it's held that a procedural violation that didn't affect the outcome is not a miscarriage of justice, but there's a space in between. And Pettiford does not address that space either, because in Pettiford, the question was whether the ACCA sentence was invalid or not, but the petitioner in that case already had three other valid convictions.
Well, but if it had been ordinary error, they wouldn't have used the very ramped up term miscarriage of justice. I mean, just, and you and I agree that that is the standard, and it's not error correction. It's a miscarriage of justice. It's the fourth prong of Olano. It denotes something really out of the ordinary.
And that is exactly what a career offender error is, Your Honor. Because it labels somebody as a recidivist, and if that's incorrectly done, there is nothing to connect that person to the guideline range that's selected. Because unlike every other guideline range, which depends on the circumstances of the offense, for career offender, the only circumstance in question is whether that person is a qualifying recidivist or not. So in this case, where Whiteside is not a qualifying recidivist, but nevertheless, he got a sentence that doubled his guideline range and resulted in about 8 years more imprisonment, that is an extraordinary error, and it is a fundamental miscarriage of justice.
So it doesn't matter to you that the career offender guideline is advisory. It doesn't matter to you that the district court could impose the very same sentence upon remand. It doesn't matter to you that the district court did nothing wrong. It acted within its discretion, and it acted within its statutory authority. It doesn't matter to you that the government did nothing wrong, that the government broke no promises. It doesn't matter to you that there were no procedural infirmities or substantive errors at the time that the case was decided. You think it's still perfectly cognizable, despite the fact that both the government and the district court did absolutely nothing wrong.
That's a lot of questions there, Your Honor, and I'm going to try to address each one of them without forgetting one. But if I forget one, please
tell
me.
No, I'm saying in that totality, if all of these things are correct, and it's still a miscarriage of justice, then we're going to have an awful lot of things constitute a miscarriage of justice. And it's not going to be limited to the career offender provision you seem to want to carve out, because the career offender provision is a guideline. I don't see the necessarily a limiting principle as opposed to a limiting statement.
First of all, let me begin with addressing the court's statement that Whiteside's sentence was correct when it occurred, because that is not true. His sentence was never correct, and the Supreme Court recognized this in Boozley. That is the case where the court held that the Bailey rule was retroactive.
Well, it was correct in the sense that it followed the law existing at the time, which was the Harp decision.
But that decision was incorrect. And what the court
But it wasn't
Boozley,
correct at the time that at the time the district court was required to follow the law.
No, I disagree, Your Honor. That decision was never correct. And that's what Boozley points out. When the court is interpreting a statute, even if it overrules prior precedent, all it is saying is what the statute has meant all along. Simmons is a case of statutory interpretation, and it overruled Harp and Jones, and it makes clear that Harp and Jones were never correct. Whiteside was not correctly sentenced at the time that he was sentenced.
Well, then at any time, by that rationale, there's no limit to it, because any time a district court follows the law and then there's a change in the law, you come back and say, well, there's been a change in the law, therefore the earlier law was never correct, or the earlier law was, that the earlier decision was never correct. And it just, it seems to me, to your response to me simply seems to me to just completely open the floodgates. If we take this open-ended view, we're going to be overrun.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because this case, the rule that I'm asking the court to apply here is limited in important respects. First of all, it has to be a retroactive decision. And what the court's talking about in terms of whether the decision was correct at the time it was imposed or not basically goes to the retroactivity decision that the court issued in Miller, deciding that Simmons is retroactive. And that's what the court was talking about in Boozley, too, when it pointed out that when the court interprets a statute, it's merely saying what the statute meant all along. But also, by limiting the rule to career offenders, that significantly limits who the rule would apply to. And there are valid bases for distinguishing career offenders from other guidelines errors, as I've pointed out.
I don't know. I mean, the whole point was made that the guidelines influence sentences. And there are many, many guideline provisions that influence sentences. And some of them make a dramatic difference.
That's true, but I'm not asking the court to impose a rule that all guideline sentences are subject to collateral review. The panel got it right when it imposed basically two restrictions on the rule. The first limitation is that the guideline error has to be extraordinary, and career offender satisfies that rule. It is extraordinary. It's completely different from any other guideline designation. But the second point is that the real limitations on post-Booker sentencing discretion recognized in Pew and reinforced by this court's post-Booker sentencing decisions have to be taken into account. You can't just ignore what Pew says about the post-Booker sentencing scheme harnessing sentencing decisions to the guidelines. And that system of post-sentencing review, both the requirement that the court start with the sentencing guidelines, that it enunciate any reasons for varying from the guidelines, and that this court then applies substantive reasonableness review, all of that limits the court's discretion. It's not a free-for-all. The court can't just go in.
I still haven't heard anything from you that indicates every time there is a change in the law subsequent to the sentencing, and after the point of direct appeal, but any time in the future that there's a change in the law and we can get to the point of saying that it may have a, quote, significant impact, unquote, then the district court has to do it again. And, you know, I don't understand how we ever have any concept of closure or finality. I realize some people don't like the word, but it's absolutely crucial to the functioning of a judicial system, and you're going to have a tectonic shift if resources are directed to the extent that your rule opens up from trial and direct appeal into collateral review under such an open-ended standard that even where the district court could do the very same thing, even where the district court acted within its discretion and within its statutory authority, that the district court has to go back and do it all over again. And there's no limit to that.
It is limited, Your Honor, because it would only apply to career offenders. And in this case, the district court could not have sentenced Whiteside to a sentence at or below his correct guideline range in this case, because it was limited by this erroneous mandatory minimum that cabined the district court's discretion to go below the 20 years to reasons related to his substantial assistance. So it's incorrect to say that the district court could have imposed a sentence in the correct guideline range. It did not have that discretion. And it's also incorrect to say that if it's remanded, the court could impose the same 210-month sentence when Whiteside's guideline range would have been correctly at the time 140 to 175. Now, because of minus two, it'll be down to 120 to 150 months. And he substantially assisted the government. So it's really impossible to conceive of reasons that the district court could give for varying upward to 210 months from that range, considering the facts in this case.
Ms. Hester, over here, you seem to have skipped over the equitable tolling issue and whether you're properly here in the first place.
I would love to address that issue.
Okay. If you could then frame it in the context under the requirement of Holland that there has to be an extraordinary circumstance that stood in your way and that it prevented a timely filing. What was the extraordinary circumstance that operated to prevent a timely filing?
Here, the extraordinary circumstances were binding circuit precedent rejecting the argument that Whiteside makes today.
Okay, what prevented a timely filing? Well, even if we were to agree that the existence of pre-Simmons law was an extraordinary circumstance, what prevented timely filing here?
Well, let me continue because in addition...
Well, if you could answer my question and then continue as you please, but you have to get over the hurdle that it prevented a timely filing, do you not?
Yes, but under Holland, the prevention doesn't have to be something that actually prevents the person from putting pen to paper and filing something in the court. It has to be something that prevented him from completing a meaningful...
It talks about timeliness.
It talks
prevented
about...
Prevented timely filing. What
correct.
Prevented timely filing in this case?
Well, the circumstances in this case were the lack of the Simmons decision plus a ruling in Powell that Karachuri doesn't apply retroactively, which makes this case very unusual.
So anytime there's a case that prevents your recovery, it's futile and prevented a timely filing?
No. The difference in this case is that there's binding circuit precedent in advance that makes it futile, plus a ruling by this court that the preceding cases, Karachuri, does not apply retroactively. So what that means is, well, I'll use Troy Powell as an example. That's the only example that the government provides of a post-conviction petitioner who filed before Simmons. But he filed before Simmons, and his motion was dismissed because Karachuri was found not retroactive, and he still has...
There were a great many petitioners who were filing within a year of their final appeal, notwithstanding the fact that Simmons hadn't come down. There were challenges to these rulings well before Simmons came down. Those other petitioners were not prevented.
The vast majority of those cases, Your Honor, were direct appeals. not post-conviction petitions. And there is a big difference between a direct appeal and a post-conviction petition, because an appellant...
Well, not all of them were direct appeals. And,
well,
and the point I'm making is that they were challenging Harp well before Simmons actually came down. So just in point of fact, how could that be a prevention? And also, how do you get around the language in Bowsley? Because I think this is a threshold issue. A statute of limitations is a threshold issue. And if the filing is untimely, to sort of drift into the previous discussion we had about manifest injustice comes to seem kind of unnecessary and pretty much like an advisory opinion. And I don't understand how you get around this direct language from the Supreme Court, which says petitioner also contends that his default, we're talking here about cause and a procedural default, as you know, should be excused because, quote, before Bailey, any attempt to attack his guilty plea would have been futile. This argument, too, is unavailing. As we clearly stated in Engle, futility cannot constitute cause if it means simply that a claim was unacceptable to that particular court at that particular time. And the fact that if we hold that adverse precedent is going to prevent someone from filing, again, this is opening up collateral attack to something. I say again, we're going to be absolutely overrun. And it's not a matter of our administrative convenience. It's a matter of taking the limited resources of a criminal justice system and shifting them to a significant extent from trial and direct appeal, where they can do the most good because the case is fresher, toward an endless series of collateral attacks where any change in circuit law or precedent can unleash a new set of filings because the old precedent prevented a timely filing. I mean, how unlimited can you get?
Well, first of all, I disagree with the court that a ruling in Whiteside's favor on equitable tolling will result in a flood of petitions. In fact, I think that a contrary ruling will result in a flood of petitions, because what that will do is it will tell petitioners that they have to challenge every existing precedent that might bother them in order to preserve their right to raise it later.
But they will do it in a timely way, and that's what Congress wanted, because this decision became final in August of 2010. Simmons came down in August of 2011, and you filed almost two years after the decision became final. But suppose under your scenario, Simmons had come down 5 or 10 years later instead of roughly 1 year after your decision became final. Under your theory, all you have to do is file 1 year after the change, not 1 year after the decision becomes final, which is how Congress structured this 2255F, but 1 year after the decision comes down that changes the law. So if it comes down 5 or 10 years later, under your view, you still have 1 year. So it would be 6 years later, 11 years later, when the filing is accomplished. And what does that do to Congress's idea that we might want to have some basic freshness in the evidence when we decide these matters?
Well, I think it sounds like the court may disagree with the equitable tolling idea at all, but Holland versus Florida approves equitable tolling in 2255 cases. So that is the territory that we're working with.
You're talking about 2255F?
Yes.
Which one? There's four alternatives there. Which one do you fall under?
No, I'm talking about the court's decision in Holland explaining that equitable tolling applies to the AEDPA.
Right, but the court said that you had to prove that you were prevented from timely filing, and I don't think you still answered why you were prevented from timely filing.
This is not futility. This is futility plus.
Right. I'm talking about Holland, though. The precise language of Holland, on which you're relying, apparently, says that you have to show that you were prevented from timely filing.
And what I'm saying is that in Holland, the circumstances were...
No, not in Holland. Here. What here prevented you from timely filing? I don't think you've answered that yet.
What prevented him from timely filing were the court's precedents clearly making it clear that his claim didn't have any merit, and the court's precedent, additional precedent, that if he relied on Karachuri, that would not be retroactive, and that he would then burn his one chance to file a 2255 if he filed based on a non-retroactive Supreme Court case. He would...
No, that just runs flat into these Supreme Court cases, and also equitable tolling on a high... This is a highly developed statute of limitations. It's not just your ordinary statute of limitations, which says 2 years, whatever. This statute of limitation was something that Congress crafted. It's highly reticulated. It presents these four situations. And when you say equitable tolling, that's reserved for extraordinary circumstance. And prevention, as Judge Keenan said, is not a matter of unfavorable precedent. It's a matter of the opposing party doing something. That's classic equitable tolling, where the actions of the opposing party, not the lay of the land as to the precedent, prevents you, some kind of concealment or some kind of foul play on the part of the opposing party. But we don't have that here, and that's generally what is meant by an extraordinary circumstance.
Actually, Holland is just to the contrary, isn't it?
Exactly. That's what I was about to
point out. In Holland, Florida did absolutely nothing to prevent Holland from filing. And in fact, Justice Scalia's dissent in Holland makes the very point that's just been made, that there was nothing, absolutely nothing, that prevented Mr. Holland from filing his own 2254. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And the majority of the court in Holland categorically rejected Justice Scalia's approach.
That's correct. And as Judge Davis, I think, as Judge Gregory pointed out in the panel majority opinion, in Holland, the question was whether Holland's own counsel had prevented him from timely filing, and typically the court infers that that's the defendant's agent. So that should be an even more difficult case in which to find equitable tolling than a case like this, where it's actually a set of adverse court decisions that prevented Whiteside from timely filing.
Didn't the government waive the statute of limitations in some of those Simmons cases?
In many, many of them, the government has waived the statute of limitations. But they drew the line at career.
How'd they pick and choose over which ones they were going to waive on?
Well, Ms. Ray may be able to answer that better than I, but they waived it.
Well, you were in most of them.
Yes. They waived them for actual innocence cases where people were innocent of 922Gs, cases where the sentence was above the statutory maximum, and cases where the sentence, where an erroneous mandatory minimum was imposed.
I'm sorry. When you say above the statutory maximum, how can a sentence be above the statutory maximum?
It happened in a few ACCA cases, Your Honor.
You mean the non-enhanced maximum. Is that what you're...
Right, the correct...
I don't think any district judges in this circuit impose sentences above the statutory maximum.
Well, they did in some ACCA...
They don't do it on purpose.
They did it in some ACCA cases. That's where it came up, because ACCA bumps the statutory maximum up. So
that's the new statutory maximum.
Right, but where that was incorrectly calculated, then the correct sentence was above the statutory
maximum. So people got sentences of more than 10 years...
Right.
...when they should not have.
Right.
And the government has waived limitations or appeal waivers in those cases.
Right, and agreed to relief. Correct. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Hess. Let's hear from Ms. Ray.
May it please the court, Amy Ray for the United States. Your Honor, the district court in this case properly declined to equitably toll the statute of limitations in this case, and the district court in this case properly held that even if not barred by untimeliness, Mr. Whiteside did not present a cognizable claim for relief under Section 2255. First, as to the equitable tolling issue, it does require extraordinary circumstances under Holland versus Florida that prevented the timely filing. This court's decision in Minter versus Beck established that futility is not enough, as did Bowsley. And their Section 2255F3 explicitly addresses when a new case decision, when new authority reopens the limitations period. And that is when there is a Supreme Court decision that is made retroactively applicable on collateral review. So to equitably toll the statute of limitations under these circumstances would be to undermine a congressional determination as to when new authority is enough, what kind of new authority reopens the limitations period. So it isn't only that there were no extraordinary circumstances, and there weren't. And I note that there were many defendants who did file timely, make this argument within the time that Mr. Whiteside could have made the argument. As I was preparing for oral argument, I remembered, I don't know why I didn't before the panel, but in January of 2011, this court asked the parties in the Michael Trent, this was after the panel argument in Simmons, asked the parties to actually look and see how many cases were pending that made the Carachuri-Rosendo argument. This was before en banc had been granted. And the federal defenders filed a letter in the Michael Trent appeal noting that 62 cases at that time, the defendants had made the Carachuri-Rosendo argument. So while it may have been futile to make it, many defendants were making it, and there was no reason why Mr. Whiteside, at that point, he was within the one-year limitations period. He could have been making the same argument.
The 1 year expired in June of 2011?
I think the 1 year expired in August of 2011, about 2 weeks before Simmons issued, if I'm not mistaken.
Simmons was August 17th, 2011.
It was. Right. Day that I remember, but yes. I think it was August 3rd when the limitations period ran for Mr. Whiteside.
And the whole point is that it's not 1 year after Simmons. It's 1 year after the conviction becomes final.
Absolutely, because if Congress intended it to be 1 year after Simmons, Congress wouldn't have limited F3 the way it did. Congress limited it to Supreme Court decisions.
So you're saying there were some defendants who actually did argue the benefit of Simmons before Simmons became law.
That's right.
And they retained it. So let me follow that now. If what you're essentially doing is saying, why wouldn't a defense counsel just argue every case that's out there pending that potentially could affect a sentence? Is that what you're saying?
You betcha. They have to.
And the end result, because we've had a lot of talk going about in terms of, you know, the fact that no one did anything wrong in terms of the issue that we may get to. But the end result is that we're dealing with an instance in which persons' liberty have been deprived under the law that existed at that time, but now we find that that law really was not the law it should have been. And the effect is being talked about quite a bit, and that is the effect would be, oh, we're going to have a whole bunch of these cases coming up, and we're going to give the judges a lot more work and the prosecutors a lot more work. And yet, the ultimate, the first determination is pretty much made. It does affect it. I mean, that's done. The only question is, how does it affect it? Isn't that pretty limited? I mean, in a case like this, I mean, how much work would that be? Knowing now that doesn't apply, you don't have to go back through the whole, argue the whole thing. You can pretty much accept, well, it does apply. So,
Your Honor.
And answer this, because I thought I heard this. Do you waive the statute of limitations in some instances?
We do. The department has made the decision, the Department of Justice, to waive the statute of limitations.
So you control when people able to have their rights, not the court. You make a decision.
There are two.
But if you chose not to waive it, could you have waived it here?
We could have. We could have exercised our prosecutorial
discretion. You just didn't feel like it that morning to waive it.
We did not believe that he had presented a cognizable claim for relief under 2255. The department looked at all the different claims.
Well, you'd waive if you'd simply waive the one-year statute, mm-hmm. your theory of the one-year statute, and if you're position on the cognizable claim on under 225 is correct, you're still going to win, aren't you?
Yes. But we assert procedural bars. The department made the decision in the wake of Senate.
But it looks like the government was picking and choosing on who gets the benefit of the statute waivers, limitation waivers, after the Simmons case.
It is.
It doesn't really look that fair. It looks like you just do it a blanket waiver.
Well,
claims be decided on their merit.
With all due respect, it's the determination was made that we would waive the statute of limitations and other procedural bars, which we did not have to do. We could have asserted those every time.
But you did it on some cases.
We did it where there were
a whole group of cases. I remember having some of them. You may have been in them, but
probably.
But your point,
but you didn't waive them all.
No, but we did it on a principled basis where they had presented a cognizable.
That's what I'm getting at. Whether doing it, picking and choosing, can be a principled basis, or whether you've got to do a blanket waiver for it to be a principled waiver.
Well, I don't think we do. I mean, I think the department made the decision that it was principled to waive the statute, the procedural, all the procedural defenses, appeal waiver, post-conviction waivers, all of those, when the petitioner had presented a cognizable and meritorious claim for relief. And that was just by the exercise of prosecutorial discretion. There are two bodies under the separation of powers who get to decide when someone can assert a timely claim. Congress and then the executive has the prerogative to determine when to waive the statute of limitations. And in this case, the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, decided and directed the U.S. Attorney's offices to waive the statute of limitations in cases where there were meritorious claims. And at the same time, we went through a very extensive process of determining what were meritorious claims.
But the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense.
Yes.
And any party, any litigant, and you are a litigant in this situation, mm-hmm. has it within their discretion when to advance an affirmative defense and when not to advance affirmative defense. And it's been going on for a long time that the Department of Justice establishes guidelines as to when they want to waive an affirmative defense, as when they want to raise an affirmative defense, and when they didn't. And in this case, you thought the underlying claim was not cognizable because it was an advisory guidelines calculation and because it was procedurally and substantively in accord with the law at the time. And as a result, you wanted to win the case, and you asserted the timeliness as an affirmative defense, which you have every right to do based on your assessment of the underlying validity of the claim.
That's right.
Sounded like Judge Wilkerson was at the meeting almost.
He was not.
Certainly did a good job because you said amen to everything he said. Well, but what the question is that you're not just every litigant. You're the Department of Justice.
Absolutely.
And you're telling me you use principle, and I'm using your word, principle means to determine who would get justice. You don't think you fall in the curtilage of your principles when you're sitting in a federal prison 8 years more than we know that in the law is wrong?
Your Honor, it is not the Department of Justice that has determined when a cognizable claim has been, what constitutes a cognizable claim under Section 2255. That is Congress. And what the department did was look an honest and careful look after Simmons at what was cognizable and what wasn't. And the truth is that under an advisory guidelines system, it has to be a complete miscarriage of justice, not any error, not a typical guidelines error. It has to be extraordinary, and there has to be some limiting basis to understand what's different. Career offender errors occur. They are actually not that extraordinary in terms of their nature. They occur. Guideline errors occur. Congress made the determination that it had to be a complete miscarriage of justice. And this court noted that it had to render the proceedings irregular and invalid. There was absolutely nothing.
It is invalid. Counsel made a good argument, which you said, it's like Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. When you're a career offender, and to say that just cavalierly, that's just a guideline advisory, no. That is meant to put manacles on you with mandatory minimums, and you don't get from under that at all. That's an incredible stigma, and it can be. And how do you become one? Isn't it correct that you could be a career offender with all of your previous or predicate offenses being just possession of cocaine? Not trafficking, but just possession. Isn't that right?
Well, it depends. In North Carolina, it would depend on what your prior record level was.
But just possession. You don't have to be a drug trafficker. You could have in state conviction, possession of cocaine, another possession of cocaine, and then the federal government comes and picks your case out and says, we want this one because you can be a career. That's an incredible label and category you go through. And you, not you, but now we know he is improperly in that scarlet letter. And he can't get it off his back, so much to the point that this minus two won't even apply to him. So that 8 years too long is now really 10 years too long, probably, in the calculation. And you're saying in the Department of Justice, you use principled determination. And in answer to Judge King's question, you still haven't told me how you did it, whether it was favorable, is one day you're the good king or the good queen, or I want to be generous this day, and you say that. But where is the court's authority under what was the great writ was one time and what equity means to have the power to do so? Well, and I want you to ask it, why don't we have the power to do what your principles under justice didn't?
Because the AEDPA does not provide this court with the power to correct anything other than a complete miscarriage of justice. And we can disagree on what constitutes an extraordinary error, except that it is clear from this court's decision.
Sitting in prison for 8 years more than you require.
Your Honor, first of all, there.
Is that
this
pretty extreme? Is that, do you think that's extreme?
I agree that if in fact he is sitting in prison for 8 years longer, that is a very unfortunate and significant. I don't know if I would say extreme, but it's pretty bad. But this is the problem.
These predicate convictions were never vacated, and in the underlying proceeding, the district court actually departed downward from the career offender statute and said, this is what I think the sentence should be. There was a 20% downward departure. And what did the district court take into account? It took into account the PSI recommendation of a criminal history category of 5, which I haven't heard seriously disputed. And there is a long, long record here of not just controlled substance offenses, but obstruction of justice, violent assaults. And the district court even so departed downward, said this is the sentence I think should happen. Probably going to give the very same sentence again, which I think you are entitled to take into account. You know, people maybe don't like the career offender statute. Unfortunately, it's the law.
That's right. And that's the district court in this case had the discretion. And the district court in the sentencing transcript, it not only took into account the recidivism, but also the youthful character of this defendant, and said that he was imposing a sentence consistent with the sentencing objectives of 3553A. So this isn't a situation where we know for sure that this defendant is serving 8 years. And with all due respect, Judge Gregory, the career offender guideline does not result in a mandatory minimum. It results in an advisory range that the court is free to accept or reject in accordance with the 3553A sentencing factors. And sure, there is a meaningful appellate review that this court made clear in Carter, for example, but that does not mean that there was any lack of discretion here. The court had the discretion to impose a fair sentence. The court determined what that fair sentence was and imposed it. And at a minimum, it didn't render the proceedings irregular and invalid.
Ms. Ray, over here.
Yes,
nice to see you.
Thank you.
Who makes the, you said the Department of Justice decided which to waive and which not to waive, which defenses to assert and which not, including statute of limitation. Where is that decision actually finally made? Do you make it?
No, Your Honor.
Is it made in Washington?
In fairness, let me say this. I will share with the court that it was a group. We all convened. We all talked. But it was primarily a final decision. It was Maine Justice. Solicitor General's Office was involved. The Attorney General's Office was involved. The U.S. Attorney's Offices in all three districts in North Carolina were involved.
You're talking about categories of cases or individual cases?
Categories.
All of them? Categories.
Categories of cases.
And you had the individual cases. You looked at those. You looked at them individually, too, didn't you?
Well, sure.
See which ones. You said you looked at them to see which ones had meritorious claims, and you decided that this fellow didn't have a meritorious claim, so you didn't waive it.
Right.
But if you came when you first got up there, you said, we win on the statute of limitations.
Right.
And we win because his claim is not cognizable under Section 2255. So you think you'd win on the merits, I mean, on the 2255 part as well.
Absolutely.
Well, why didn't you let that be decided?
Because
rather than imposing the time limit bar, and everything, it looked like, well, the government's being fair-minded here. They're letting cross the board the people take advantage of Simmons if they're possibly entitled to.
For one thing, it was our decision, right or wrong, that if there was a cognizable
decision, I'm going to make that clear.
I understand.
I know how powerful the Attorney General and the U.S. attorneys are, and you have the power to make that decision.
Well,
but it needs to look right.
We also have
to look right, and
it does.
And it has a problem of looking right when you pick and choose.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Judge King, and we do respect the statute of limitations, and we do assert it when we believe that it applies. And in this case, where there's a cognizable claim that we thought, okay, in our discretion, we're going to go ahead and waive them and allow these folks relief. And those included 922G cases where there was an actual innocence of the underlying conviction case. It included cases under the Armed Career Criminal Act where there was an improper mandatory minimum and the defendant actually received an unlawful sentence. I mean, there were these
You would want some flexibility in this thing. You wouldn't want to say categorically to the Department of Justice, you can never waive an affirmative defense. That's not where you want to go. Any litigant has some control over the assertion or the non-assertion of an affirmative defense, and it's entirely right for the Justice Department to take into account individual circumstances, such as a criminal record, or such as actual innocence, or such as whether something is an advisory guideline contention, or whether something is a mandatory minimum contention. That's the way the system ought to work. You can't put it in a rigid box.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think that in this case, the department made a fair decision. That if there was a meritorious claim, we would not assert it.
Ms. Ray,
Ms. Ray,
can I follow up? I was going to ask you another couple questions about decision making.
Sure.
In fact, you claim, and I accept that you made some principal decision. You were going through the cases on when you would waive and when you wouldn't waive. I'm just asking for my own edification. You didn't have the final, absolute decision yourself as to when to waive and what when not to waive, did you?
No, I did not. Not as to categorically. I mean,
okay.
we had them in categories.
So now, based on what you've heard here today, are you going to take back to whoever makes that ultimate decision the recommendation that they either waive it for everybody or waive it for nobody?
I don't know that I would, Judge Shedd. No. I think that it is a fair affirmative defense for us to argue when we do not think that the defendant has.
But you understand the thrust of my question, don't you?
I do. But I think that where the petitioner does not have a viable claim, in our estimation, our reading of the law, our intellectual.
Can I just stop? Because this is the part of the policy I'm not understanding. In a circuit that had held that errors like this were in fact cognizable, would you then waive the limitations period because in that circuit there is a meritorious claim? How does this work? What role does the court get to play?
I think that the answer, Judge Harris, I don't know other than the department's position continues to be, and I think it's the legally correct one, mm-hmm. that these errors are not cognizable. So far, there is no circuit that has finally determined that they are. And because of that, we don't really face that question. But if we did, my guess is that we would continue to assert the statute of limitations because until the Supreme Court resolved that circuit conflict, or until the administration took a different position on the cognizability of those claims.
And this is, I guess, a slightly related question. So do you agree with what I think has already been said today, that for our purposes today, timeliness is sort of a threshold question, and if we think this motion wasn't timely filed, we're done? So we will not actually have a chance to reach that cognizability question, which might then in turn affect the department's position on waiver. See what I'm saying?
There's like a little, I do, although I do, but I don't believe it would actually affect the department's position on waiver, and I want to be very clear about that, because I think even if this court were to hold that these errors were cognizable, the department does not believe that's true, and with all due respect to the intellectual prowess of this court, I think the department would continue to hold that until either their weight of authority was such or a different administration.
But all you have done here, and I don't think there's foul play on the Department of Justice, you've asserted an affirmative defense that was provided you by Congress with respect to a claim which you felt was non-cognizable and you wanted to defeat, and you wanted to win the case. You asserted affirmative defense. The affirmative defense was one provided you explicitly by Congress, and you asserted it in a case where you thought the underlying claim was non-cognizable, and you, as any litigant would want to win, and felt you should win. As a matter of justice, you felt you should win. And that's all you've done, and I don't see that it's malodorous.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would note that just in terms of this conversation about what the department does and why, this administration's decision to waive in any class of cases is, in my experience as 10 years as a prosecutor, fairly extraordinary. The department made the decision to do that, but they didn't do it without dissent, and they didn't do it without some pretty close conversation about whether it was okay or what would happen if we start waiving in an entire class of cases. But we did that. And the decision was to do that because we thought that that was the just result. And at the same time, combined with the decision was, what does Congress allow here? What is a cognizable claim? And the mandatory minimum question, it was tough. That was a difficult question. And the answer ultimately was that we determined, in our estimation, that it's a cognizable claim. And this court has yet to pass on that post-Simmons. But the department made the decision to waive in this class of cases, and they did it with, I can only tell you, long and considered decision making. And
that's the problem, counsel. When you have a system like this, I thought a big part of these sentencing guidelines and these things was to try to have equity as far as you could. Mm-hmm. And now you have a carve-out where you decide, principal or otherwise, we don't know what you do, really. I mean, how it happens, but we do know. And there are many cases where you assert them and you don't assert them. I don't know how you do that. And I take it what you said, and I know you in terms of your integrity, so I don't besmirch it at all. That's what you do. But it happens. But you might show mercy, but you can't be just. So what you're really telling me is that we have instances of mercy, but that's what courts are for, justice. And that's why the great writ and equitable tolling is a part of this court's function, not sitting on the other side of the curtain and just waiting on you to be merciful to someone. It's a question of whether or not just. And a person sitting in prison for 8 years more than that, I don't believe that our hand is shortened. And I just don't believe that. And here, in terms of Judge Wilkinson, brings up a point of finality. Here's what finality is now. And that's fine. But now the commission is now going to give the minus two. That's going to be about 46,000 cases that will be gone through the system. So finality has gone out the window a long time ago in terms of that sense. Now, is the Justice Department is going to object to that court's having to resentence those people?
No, I think is essentially a done deal.
You answered the question, you're not going to object. But let me see the irony of that. Here's the irony. Think about this. I'm not against this, but think about it. 46,000 people whose sentence were correct then and still are correct are going to get relief. But a person whose sentence we know is incorrect now, the court can't do anything about it?
Your Honor, Section 3582 3582C2, someone may have, I'm sorry if I'm talking over someone, I can't
quite
tell.
Oh, you're not,
3582C2 provides defendants the ability to take advantage of a retroactively applicable guideline reduction. That is Congress. 2255, established by Congress, the AEDPA, provides a limited claim for relief for correction of certain errors. And that statute also contains a statute of limitations. And that statute of limitations explicitly addressed when new case law authority should reopen the statute of reopen the limitations period. And it provided for Supreme Court decisions. It did not provide that circuit court decisions, no matter how dramatic, no matter whether they completely overturned binding previous circuit court precedent, that statute does not reopen the limitations period for new case law unless it is Supreme Court decisions. Whether we like it or not, whether we think it is fair or not, that is the decision that Congress made. So Congress has carved out certain instances where a defendant or a prisoner may get a reduced sentence. 3582C2 is one of those instances. But Congress provides a statute of limitations in this case, as well as a standard of cognizability that, interpreted by the Supreme Court, requires a complete miscarriage of justice.
And I guess in response to our sort of dismay that the Department of Justice is picking and choosing when it would assert a limitations, that the ready response is the department did this as a matter of grace, and it could have had a unilateral rule that was going to do it in every case. The reason why the rule is or your procedure is articulated to us, at least strikes me, I speak only for myself, as a little questionable, is that you've made the call on the underlying claim, a call that we may disagree with, but we might agree with you on limitations. Mm-hmm. But I take your point that you, in close cases, you're not asserting limitations, is basically what you're saying to us. In close cases in the department's view. Whether we think it's a close case or not is something else.
Sure. I mean, I don't know that I would characterize them as close cases. They were just, you know, it was a decision of what's cognizable and what's not based on Supreme Court and circuit case law. And the determination was made the career offender error is a guideline error. There was a concern about there being no way, really, faithfully, to distinguish between a guideline error in the career offender context and a 16-level enhancement in the illegal reentry context, or a fraud loss calculation in a fraud context that could have equally severe consequences for a particular defendant. We looked at both the sort of what constitutes an extraordinary error, what is a complete miscarriage of justice, and based on the case law, and this was a legal reasoning, not discretion. This was an assessment that the Section 2255 doesn't provide a claim for relief, a cause of action, for a defendant who suffers an ordinary guideline error, and that the career offender error is just as, in terms of the nature of that error, in this, particularly in the advisory guidelines, now that we're post-Booker, and this judge did exercise his discretion to go below the applicable guideline range as he understood it, that is not a complete miscarriage of justice. And so because of that, we made the determination that we would not waive the statute of limitations in that class of cases.
In order to hold this a timely filing, we would have to do so much. We would be up against 2255 F3 and its particular provision for when equitable tolling lies and when it does not. So we would not only be up against an act of Congress, we would be up against explicit expressions on the part of the Supreme Court and in Bowsley and in Engle. We would be up against explicit expressions about extraordinary circumstances being required. And in addition, we would be courting separation of powers concerns if we tried to take as a basis for saying that this is equitable tolling our view of how you should exercise your discretion and how you should not. I mean, prosecutors, as a matter of separation of powers, do exercise discretion. You exercise discretion in whom to prosecute and in whom not. The Department of Justice has detailed guidelines on that. AUSAs follow the guidelines, but they also have some discretion in how they apply the guidelines. So all I'm saying is that to find this timely, we're up against a classic notion of prosecutorial discretion. We're up against a clear and detailed expression on the part of Congress, and we're up against emphatic holdings of the United States Supreme Court. And that's an awful lot to overcome.
Yes, Your Honor, I see that my time is up. I certainly could not say it better or with any greater emphasis. Absolutely, the Supreme Court has made the decision that futility is not a reason to equitably toll the statute of limitations, that the case and 2255F3 establishes when new case law reopens the limitations period. And thank you, Your Honor. Thank
you. Ms. Hester.
I'd like to begin where Ms. Ray left off, talking about Boosley, because it's important to note that in Boosley, what the court is talking about is procedural default, not equitable tolling. And the circumstances are different, because in procedural default, we're talking about whether somebody raised something in a direct appeal. Well, the consequences of raising something in a direct appeal are completely different from the consequences of raising them in a post-conviction action, because there's no downside for someone to raise.
I don't understand the distinction, because if anything, the consequences of a procedural default are quite severe. You lose it. And it would be very inconsistent to say that something does not constitute cause for procedural default, but oh my gosh, it does constitute cause for a failure to file. In other words, that whole position it just meets itself going and coming. I mean, to say something doesn't constitute cause for procedural default would say, oh yeah, the very same thing does constitute cause here when there are consequences for the accused in both contexts.
Well, I agree that there are consequences for the accused in both contexts, but when the government doesn't raise procedural default, then that is not the standard that you look at. The standard you look at is whether there's equitable tolling and whether there's a miscarriage of justice, and it's not the same, because a person under 2255, if he raises a futile claim in his only 2255, he's going to be precluded from raising that again. He only gets one shot, and that's entirely different from a direct appeal. I'd like to discuss for a minute.
Let me ask you a question. How do we issue a, you don't have a COA here, Certificate Correct. Of Appealability? You need one. What's the constitutional issue in which you get a COA?
Well, the constitutional issue is the one that I led off with, which is the question under Hicks.
Is it a due process claim?
Well, it's a due process claim. Okay.
I'm going to ask that because there was one issued by the panel majority, but that panel majority decision's been vacated, so you don't have one at this point.
Correct.
You need to get somebody to issue a certificate of appealability, or then we don't have any jurisdiction even.
Right. But all the claim has to be is debatable, which is that reasonable jurists right. could disagree, and it doesn't even have to be that any one person would vote.
But
for,
it still has to issue
on the merits.
Yes,
yes, it does have to issue. But under Hicks, Whiteside has made a debate, has offered a debatable constitutional issue, and I would contend even one that he should prevail on the merits. The court found basically ruled on that exact same issue in the Narvaez case and granted a certificate.
There still has to be a timely filing.
Yes.
There still has to be a timely filing to raise constitutional or non-constitutional issues.
Yes, or equitably told. That's correct. I'd like to mention the 2255F3 argument, the argument that the fact that that provision causes accrual upon a retroactive Supreme Court decision, that does not mean that equitable tolling doesn't apply. The court specifically addressed those those accrual provisions in Holland versus Florida and said, nevertheless, equitable tolling applies because there's a presumption that equitable tolling applies, and in order to defeat that presumption, the statute must clearly state that equitable tolling doesn't apply.
Doesn't the specific control the general? And F3 is very specific about when you have a change in law. F4 addresses changes of factual circumstances. F3 addresses a change in law. That's what we have here. And doesn't that specific provision addressing change in law control over general principles, gauzy, fuzzy principles of equitable tolling where Congress has expressed itself specifically and addressed the precise point?
Not under Holland versus Florida, because the court was careful to point out in Holland versus Florida that those are accrual provisions and they aren't equitable tolling provisions, and that, so that they don't displace equitable tolling.
And in fact, the plain language of F3 doesn't even contemplate a decision made retroactively applicable by a court of appeals, does it?
No.
It talks exclusively about law made retroactively applicable by the Supreme Court. Nobody suggests here that we're in that house.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And I also point out that the whole point of Holland versus Florida is that equitable tolling requires flexibility and it disfavors mechanical rules.
By my count, Justice Breyer used the term equity about 9 times in his majority opinion in Holland.
Right.
He says the great writ is steeped in equity. I don't know how else you can read Holland other than to, at a minimum, to leave open the opportunity for a court of appeals of the United States to take the court's lead and apply the reasoning of Holland in a new factual circumstance. If we're wrong, the court will correct us.
That's right. And this is, the court has to be able to address unforeseen circumstances, and this really is an extremely unusual circumstance where the court vacated its prior precedent and at the same time held that the cases leading up to that prior precedent do not apply retroactively, mm-hmm. which puts someone who's filing a 2255 in a terrible position because there's no point in time when his claim will be considered
not
on
an
the merits.
Extraordinary
under
Holland,
exactly, under Holland, clearly, you're looking at it, this court might decide being in prison 8 years too long doesn't matter, or it's not important, not severe enough, but it cannot hide behind the fact it doesn't have the power to do so. Holland does not take away that power at all.
No.
A fair reading of it does not. So this court can decide, I don't care. Like the justice said, well, I didn't want to waive in that case because it didn't meet my principal standard. But if this court doesn't do it, it won't be because it didn't have the power, it's because it doesn't have the will to do so. I think Holland makes that clear, and that's why Justice Breyer said that. Equity still exists. The great writ still is here. That's what federal courts do. But to defer to some congressional scheme and take refuge behind that is just a clear misreading of Holland. Absolutely.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel, then take a brief recess.